I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. This is our annual, obviously, everybody does it, shows on Martin Luther King on this day that we officially remember him in the United States of America. And I can remember as a young man being one of those who fought for this day, insisting that all the employees take off and organizing people in our work to not work on that day until they made it an official holiday. And it has been made. But what does Martin Luther King really mean to all of us? So this year of 2012, a presidential election year, a year that some people put some spiritual significance to, we were thinking about how Martin Luther King's legacy really has been appropriated by almost every political, social, cultural, religious spectrum in our country. So what does it really mean? Who was he really? And we really look to two men we have with us today who some might think are on very opposite ends of the political spectrum, but in many ways have very similar thoughts on this. And both of them are MacArthur Fellows. They both won the Genius Grant, the award. Robert L. Woodson, Sr. Bob Woodson is the founder and president of the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, has been an activist all of his life and working to turn inner-city neighborhoods around, and was in the NAACP in Pennsylvania as a young man when King was alive. Charles Johnson is one of our leading authors and philosophers in America. His books, Middle Passage and Dreamer, caught this country's mind, called all of us when we read those books. He's an author and professor at the University of Washington. And I want to welcome both Bob Woodson and Chuck Johnson to this program. It's a pleasure to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, yes.
So one of the things I was thinking about, you know, in this program, you wrote this piece, Chuck Johnson, in Shambhala Sun, which is a Buddhist magazine, some time ago. And one of the lines in the magazine, you were talking about both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X when you wrote this line. And you said these two iconic and long-dead Americans suffer from the curse of canonization. I love that line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very true in terms of what we do to so many people once they've gone to kind of canonize them, sanitize them, and almost forget who they really were.
Yeah. Yes, I think King has been airbrushed over the decades. And as you say, his life and legacy have been appropriated by virtually everyone from pro-gun groups in Washington State to Louis Farrakhan. I think King is very prismatic, that this man has many sides and many dimensions. In my book, Dreamer, and in most of the writings that I've done about King, I see King as moving through three stages. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what they are very quickly. In 1955, during the Montgomery bus boycott, I think he's a civil rights leader, a local civil rights leader who gets national attention. I think that by the time, he gets the Nobel Peace Prize, King becomes a larger figure on a larger stage. He becomes a global peace advocate and takes that very seriously, and so he opposes the Vietnam War. And in the third incarnation of King, we have a man who understands that social justice requires economic justice. And so his focus is on the Poor People's March, which he didn't live to see because of the assassination of the Lorraine Motel. So I see three stages of King, all of them consistent and coherent and reinforcing the other. And so people will sometimes take one piece and leave behind the other.
And I wonder what your thoughts are on that, the canonization, the sterilization of Martin, and how you think of that, Bob.
I think his assessment is absolutely right on target. When I met King just before he died in Westchester, when we were leading a demonstration, and what struck me about King is that he defined leadership. His views and opinions were evolving. He said that real leaders don't just reflect popular opinion or the consensus of the majority, but real leaders help to shape that consensus. And everybody keeps quoting his I Had a Dream speech, but I quoted the one that's my favorite is the one that Nelson Mandela quoted when he was released from prison, and that his letter from a Birmingham jail, when he said the greatest stumbling block to black progress is not the White Citizens Council or the Ku Klux Klan, it is the white moderate. he said lukewarm acceptance from those of goodwill is more difficult to tolerate than outright rejection of those of ill will. He was accused by the traditional leadership of alienating white leadership, but Dr. King didn't care because he was more committed to principle than he was pleasing those around him.
So having said what you both just said, what do you think, when you talk to your friends, when you talk to your families about King in that period, what do you talk to them about in terms of what we should reflect upon now with that legacy? I mean, this is not 1968, it's not 1964, it's not 1955.
I'd like to jump in on that question. Mr. Woodson's talk that he gave in 1993, The Conservative Virtues of Dr. Martin Luther King, he concludes, I think, in a way that's very provocative by saying that there is a cultural challenge that we have before us. Now, every year around this time, people raise the question, what would King say if he were alive today?
Mm-hmm.
In 1994, that question was put to Congressman John Lewis, and this is a quote. He says, King would say, in addition to doing something about guns, he would say there needs to be a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas in the black community. He would say we need to accept nonviolence not simply as a technique or a means to bring about social justice, but we need to make it a way of life, a way of living. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and Mr. Woodson can correct me if I am, King's ultimate goal was what he called the beloved community. It wasn't just integrating lunch counters, for example. It was something he called the beloved community. And he reminded the freedom riders of that just mm-hmm. before they took off. So there is a vision here. It is ethical. It is philosophical. King was a trained theologian. And I think we've missed a large part of that vision, but it's what animates, I believe, the man we know through several different profiles as Martin Luther King Jr.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. And when I think about King, another way I put what you just said is grace. The mm-hmm. very fact that the man could be at an event in Birmingham and a member of the Nazi Party leaps on the stage and punches him in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And King was a wrestler. He could have very easily taken this guy out. But when his aide jumped to wrestle this man down, King embraced this man and introduced him to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it tore this man apart. King believed that the way you destroy an enemy is make him your friend.
Yes.
And so King's whole life, I have the image of his home, being there after Coretta and the young baby nearly escaped the bomb that blew up the house, and there were hundreds of blacks, armed blacks, ready to just take up arms and engage in an armed struggle. And there's King standing there counseling everybody, counseling peace at a time when his home had been blown up and his family almost killed. Even in the face of these severe challenges, King continued to preach nonviolence. Now, I don't know of many leaders today who, in the face of those kinds of threats and challenges, could still remain faithful to the principles of nonviolence. That's the leadership that I talk about of King.
I think that beautifully sums up the man. Going back to that very night when his baby and wife, new baby and wife, were in that house, and it was bombed. Fortunately, they were not hurt. Black people were ready to tear apart the police. King came back. And he told them to put down their guns. And he said, we must meet hatred with love.
That's right.
And that was a turning point. I believe in the 200 or 300-year-old black liberation struggle. We did not hear that message of nonviolence from anybody. We didn't hear it from Nat Turner. We didn't hear it from Frederick Douglass. We didn't hear it from W.E.B. Du Bois. This was a moment of tremendous, I think, importance. Now, in my novel, 1998 novel, Dreamer, I try to isolate three characteristics that I would use to characterize King. One is nonviolence, as you talked about it, and Congressman Lewis talked about it. The other is agape, which is the way that God loves supposedly man. In other words, you don't love the person as they are at the moment, because they might be like George Wallace at, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, and they're very unlovable. They're like that Nazi who jumped on stage. But what you love is their potential. It's the kind of love that a parent has for your child when they're going through a difficult period, like during puberty. You know, it's like I have a daughter who's now 30, but when she was 12 or 13, she was going through a lot of stuff. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking to myself, you know, I love this child, but today I don't like her. but I hold out the hope that she's going to get through this, you know, with my help, and she's going to emerge. And so the idea, which is also Gandhi's idea, you know, in terms of the British, he said, we don't want them, we want them to leave. They have to leave. But we want them to leave as our friends. So you, satyagraha, which means truth force or holding on to truth, which I think King also manifested, it means basically not humiliating your opponent, not defeating your opponent, but rather allowing your opponent to come to enlightenment, to join the ranks of the enlightenment as a friend. That's a radically different way of dealing with social conflict.
And also, I would say about King's leadership, he did not seek celebrity the way those who act in his name do today.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, King didn't even, King died without even having insurance or will.
Yeah.
He's not like some of these celebrity predatory preachers that has helicopters waiting outside and poor parishioners inside.
He gave his Nobel Prize money
right.
to two or three different civil rights organizations. He was being paid back in the 50s, $500, maybe $1,000, which is a lot of money for a speech or a sermon, but he gave that money, again, to groups working for women's rights and black people's rights, and kept nothing for himself.
Absolutely. And so he really epitomized, but like you say, they airbrushed him. You don't hear that dimension of what he's done, but the sheer grace. Also, King, wouldn't you agree with me that King also talked about we must address the enemy within the black community?
That's right. That's right.
He spoke out against the violence of the Klan, but he also spoke out with equal vigor against retaliatory violence of the Black Panther Party.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. One of my favorites.
And he got into a lot of trouble for that. But King was a man who was more faithful to principle. And also remember, I was on the dais in Darby, Pennsylvania, when the day that King joined the Civil Rights Movement with the Peace Movement. And I almost stormed off because Roy Wilkins, who was head of the NAACP, castigated King. It was Carl Rowan, the black columnist for the Washington Post, who called King a communist for taking this position. So he was a man who created upheaval within the civil rights community.
That's right, and within the black community. I remember that time. The newspapers were vicious towards King when he became a opponent of the Vietnam War, and LBJ was extraordinarily disappointed because he felt he had done a lot for civil rights, and he felt that King's opposition to the war was a slap in the face. One of my favorite quotes from King, and it's kind of early on, late 50s maybe, he said, we must work on two fronts. On the one hand, we must continually resist the system of segregation, the system which is the basic cause of our lagging standards. On the other hand, we must work constructively to improve the lagging standards, which are the effects of segregation. There must be a rhythm of alteration between attacking the cause and healing the effects. He got criticized for saying that, you know, for looking within as well as looking without at problems that had to be solved. But I think while we have focused on the first part, the external system of segregation and discrimination and all of that, we tend not to look within. We have to improve ourselves. One of King's favorite sermons, the one he says was the most favorite of all his sermons, is called The Three Dimensions of a Complete Life. And I think this is a really beautiful sermon. What he says is that the first dimension of a complete life is self-acceptance. This means developing your personal resources, abilities, intelligence, and talent. It also means life, doing life's work, quote, so well that the living, the dead, or the unborn couldn't do it better. Another time, you know, he talks about it in terms of these two fronts. Now, the second dimension he talks about is this. He says that we have to learn that there's nothing greater than to do something for others. And then the third dimension for King is the quest for the divine. He said, we were made for God, and we must be restless until we find rest in him. He gave that speech all across the South, you know, all across America. He gave it in London at St. Paul's Cathedral in 1964 when he was on his way to Norway to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. So three dimensions he talks about, one in relation to ourselves, one in relationship to others, unselfishness and giving and generosity, and finally our relationship to the divine, our spiritual life. That, too, has to be taken into account.
One of the things that you know, I think that it's important to do is not just to, you know, how people argue and say, talk about, well, what would Martin Luther King say or do if he was alive now in 2012 with the Occupy movement or the war in Iraq or the income gap or whatever somebody wants to put on the table, or the violence inside the inner city. And it's always a kind of an interesting game people play with that. But to me, it's almost more important to begin to reflect on when you look at history and our historical figures and those who dwell deeply in thought about where we need to go as a species, as a planet, and we're active in that. Not so much what they would do, but what do we glean from what they said about what we can do?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? How do we build on that? So, and all the things you both have just said. Let me just take one now and maybe get to a few more before the end of the hour. And when you both talked earlier on about nonviolence, and I think about this world we're in now, that we are in the midst of so much violence, whether it's the day-to-day violence of what's happening on television and sports, and really violent sports on TV, or the video games where people just, you know, I watch my grandson just ensconce in these video games where he must kill 10,000 people a day. Do you know what I mean? You watch that, or you think about the Iraq War, or what's going on in Afghanistan, or throughout the Arab Spring, the violence in our own inner cities, the violence in our country in general, the wars we have. What do we take from his legacy when we wrestle with the kind of violence that we live with in the 21st century?
Well, I'm
Chuck,
very
go ahead. Then we'll go to Bob.
Oh, go to Bob.
No,
yeah.
go ahead,
well, I would. Well, frankly, I just think that I take a more retail approach. Only 3 to 5% of Americans are entrepreneurs, but they create 70% of all the new jobs. And so, what we're trying to do in our work here is to incubate on a small scale a remedy to predatory violence among the most predatory young people in the country, and demonstrate that violence can be dramatically reduced by through the kind of interventions that we have crafted here at the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise. So we, I won't take the go into detail about how I got here, but what we do is recruit young adults from the community suffering the problems, and they are like antibodies. And we train and put them back into those same communities, because in any community, 10% of the people affect what 90% have to address. So we have been able to go into a gang-infested neighborhood where there were 53 murders in a 5-square-block area in 2 years. By intervening the way we did, by bringing these warring factions together, we were able to bring about a dramatic reduction in violence. In the last 12 years, there hasn't been a single gang-related murder in that area. And we have learned how to export that in microcosm in different parts of the country, because we take these kind of moral mentors and character coaches that are like antibodies in these communities and apply them. So So I just think all of us, from wherever we are, have to work on it on a retail basis and then try to find the resources and the means to take what's working in a few communities to rapidly let it grow so it becomes a Fortune 500 of social intervention.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Chuck?
So that's...
Yeah, well, I have a lot of feelings about this. I'm a practicing Buddhist, and so I'm very committed to nonviolence. In his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, Dr. King made a statement that I have never forgotten. He said, civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. I've always thought about that. Civilization and violence do not go together. I think, Mark, that one of the directions you were taking, your question, was along the lines of just how violent a culture we find ourselves living in today. 24/7, we are exposed to violence not only in our popular entertainment, which is why I really can't watch television anymore and don't watch a good many movies, but we're exposed to violence of a verbal kind, violence in speech, violence in the spirit that manifests itself in anger and speech that hurts others. I think that King's efforts in the direction of nonviolence went against the general character of American culture in so many, many ways. You know, one of the ways I try to talk to people about this is I talk about something that is very widespread and popular in Far Eastern and Islamic cultures. It's called the Three Gates, and that we shouldn't speak or express our thoughts and feelings, put them out in the public, until we pass them through three gates. And the three gates are three questions, and the questions are these. One, is it true what we're about to say? Two, is it necessary what we're about to say? Mm. And three, will it do no harm? If what we're about to say can pass through those three gates, then we can say it. If it can't, then I think we should remain silent. You know, every one of us, I think, can improve within ourselves in terms of reducing violence and anger and those sorts of things. So we have to work on ourselves as we work on the world outside.
But let me just say also that this is not the first time that civilization has been where we are. In the 1820s, when you got people leaving the villages coming into the cities, there was an upheaval. Young people were torn from families, mm-hmm. and you saw a dramatic rise in predatory violence. In the streets of London, people couldn't walk the streets. You had red light districts in America, and it just reached to a certain point where people were afraid to walk the streets, and then it triggered a kind of reformation. All of a sudden, you see a lot of societies began to. There were laws passed against drinking, and there was just in 30 years there was a tremendous upheaval in response to this kind of predatory existence. And I think that there is still the prospects of a kind of reformation occurring again in our lifetime once people it reaches a certain threshold where people are just get fed up. And so I'm sort of praying, as a Christian, I'm praying that this kind of reformation will come again, and all of us have a responsibility to at least plant some seeds, and that's what our work is trying to do. So if people are looking for retail ways of at least in some segments of this challenge, we are trying to provide the model so that, and there are other models around the country that we hope that people will look at and perhaps invest in, and so they can grow and form like a moral brush fire. A brush fire burns from beneath out, and I think what we need is a moral brush fire.
Do you think we need a spiritual reformation?
It has to be. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be military. Someone said what distinguishes America, in fact, it was interesting enough, there were some Chinese scientists who studied America and the West to find out what is it that made us powerful and influential. And recently they published their finding. They said it's not our political system, it's not our economy, nor is it the power of our military. They said it's America's religion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what the Chinese, who are supposed to be our enemies, that's their conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what the Founding Fathers said, that the preservation of these values will not be done because of the military our system of laws and checks and balances, but it will be the civic institutions will be the preservers of these values.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't hear liberals or conservatives talking about that.
Not much.
No, I think the question of the spiritual power of change is something that that doesn't get talked about very often. We do often talk about it in terms of religion and religious doctrine,
right?
But not in something much more universal terms.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And
it gets too confusing when you talk about it in religious terms often.
King had so many interesting ways of formulating this. A quote that comes to my mind, which I delivered, on King Day here at the University of Washington campus, as the students were getting ready to go out and repaint neighborhoods, repair things. The quote I remember I gave them was King saying, "I can't be what I need to be until you are what you need to be.
Mm.
You can't be what you need to be until I am what I need to be." So our lives are very much, our very being, our sense of identity is very much tied up with others in a relational way, in a relative and relational way. Self involves others. We can talk about these things, I think, without necessarily using the specific language of a particular religion, because these are universal insights that King had.
We're talking with Charles Johnson and Robert L. Woodson, Sr. Charles Johnson, of course, is one of America's great authors and philosophers. His books, Middle Passage and Dream, have been widely read and wrestled with. Robert L. Woodson, Sr., he is the founder and president of the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise. Both these men have been awarded the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur, what we call the Genius Award, for the work they do in this country. And we are here talking about, reflecting in 2012, on this Martin Luther King Day with these two wise men of our society. And we'll take a short break and come back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are here on Martin Luther King Day 2012 with Charles Johnson, who is author, philosopher. His books are like, among his books are Middle Passage and Dream, and you can also see his work on E-Channel, where Ethelbert Miller has been having a year-long conversation with him that we have featured in the show before. Robert L. Woodson, Sr. is founder and president of the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, and as I said before we went to break, they both are MacArthur Fellows. And I, in reflecting more on where what we can take, glean from Martin Luther King and that way of life in the world that we're in now. I think it was you, Chuck, a little bit ago, who talked about the beloved community.
Yeah.
And in this very fractious world that we're in now, on so many levels,
yeah.
How does that reflection on his notion of beloved community talk to us in 2012?
Are you familiar with a document that was signed by all the volunteers during the Birmingham campaign. It was called the Commitment Form.
Yes, yes.
You're familiar with that?
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, you know, the 10 points of that Decalogue, the Commitment Form, are kind of blueprint, I think, for living or working for the beloved community. I'll go through them real quick.
Please.
It says, I hereby pledge myself, my person and body, to the nonviolent movement. Therefore, I will keep the following commandments. 1, meditate daily on the teachings and life of Jesus. 2, remember always that the nonviolent movement seeks justice and reconciliation, not victory. 3, walk and talk in the manner of love, for God is love. 4, pray daily to be used by God in order that all men might be free. 5, sacrifice personal wishes in order that all men might be free. 6, observe with both friend and foe the ordinary rules of courtesy. 7, seek to perform regular service for others and for the world. 8, refrain from the violence of fist, tongue, or heart. 9, strive to be in good spiritual and bodily health. And 10 is follow the directions of the movement and of the captain on a demonstration. Now, I whenever I look at this, I see something that has application immediately for a demonstration, but also a larger vision for leading a life that will, in many ways, underscore and support King's idea of the beloved community.
And how do you think, and Bob Whitson, when you hear that, how do you think we can do that? How do you think we would do that now?
Well, I think before we do that, well, maybe as we do it, we've got to do what King did, and that is that we must confront directly the enemies within the black community who, in the name of civil rights, are committing fraud and abuse and are using their position to exploit our people, particularly low-income people. And I think that that many people in the name of civil rights, it's morphed into a grievance industry. I think we've allowed it to become an extension of the Democratic Party. When King and the civil rights leaders remained above the political fray. So I really think that there has got to be some cleansing to take place, and we must be some honest dialogue. We just had in Prince George's County, a county executive and his wife are going to jail for 6 years. From the time this man took office, he plotted to just enrich himself through stealing contracts. We had 5 members of our city council, one of them was getting ready to go to jail, taking monies that were designated to help low-income kids buy sports equipment. He bought a SUV with it. There has been a lot of exploitation of this legacy, and I really think there has to be some truth-telling and some cleansing.
Mr. Woodson, would you address the issue that you talk about in your talk, the issue of the whole problem of the idea of victimization?
Yeah, I mean, someone talked about it's like a farmer taking a mule across a stream, and it's 3 feet high, rushing at 20 miles an hour, and he forces the mule in it, and they both swept a mile down the shore. A year later, he comes to the same crossing, and the stream is only 6 inches high, and the mule refuses to go in. It's because the mule, like us, had good memories but poor judgment.
I love that.
The circumstances that we confronted in the 60s are not the circumstances of today.
Amen.
But there are those who would try to convince our people that the fact that our incarceration rates are, it was only 90,000 blacks in prison in 1954, which is commensurate with our percentage in the population. Today, that has risen to 900,000.
Yeah.
Now, is that because racial injustice is where it has gotten worse? No, it's because of things that we are doing. But there are people in a radio talk show hosts who are black, politicians will find excuses for that and say, well, it's because white people put guns and drugs in our community, which forced us to become killers and drug addicts. That's foolish. But, I mean, but you've got a whole industry now that continues to portray us as conditions haven't changed. They've gotten worse since the 60s. And so that must be challenged.
I couldn't agree more. I think that is one of the serious problems that we confront right now. And we certainly do not do our children any favors. We do them a disservice if we implant in their minds the idea that they are victims, that they are not empowered to improve upon their lives. You know, I go back to the 50s and think about my dad and my mom and my relatives and how they made a way out of no way, how they were moral people in the era of Jim Crow.
Yes.
And so, you know, we came out of the 60s with more credit in the bank. I mean, we were perceived as a moral people, a disciplined people, a hardworking people, a people with a kind of nobility earned through our actions and deeds. And one of the things that I grieve about most is in the last 30 or 40 years, that image has become so tarnished. And yet there are black people out there right now living like that, but they don't make the news because, you know, you only make the news if you commit a crime or something like that. Every day they're doing the work of the Lord and the work for their families and the work to improve this society, but they don't make headlines.
No, but I'm encouraging everyone to go see The Red Tails. So be in the movies on the 20th.
Oh, yeah.
There's a group called the Triple Nickel. These were the black paratroopers.
Oh, I didn't know about this.
Yes. Oh, yeah, and also the Golden 13. You know about them?
No, who were they?
In 1943, Eleanor Roosevelt insisted that the Navy didn't have black officers, and they wouldn't train them. Eleanor Roosevelt insisted, so they took 13 professional blacks, and the Navy agreed to put them through officers' training school. Well, what they did was they gave, normally the Officers' Canada School is 16 weeks, so they said, well, the way we're going to flunk these blacks out, we're going to give them in 8 weeks what we would give whites in 16 weeks. So when these brothers found out what the game was, they covered the windows in their barracks with blankets, and they stayed up all night and studied. So when they were tested, they scored in the 90th percentile.
They're like the Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah, so then the Navy says, well, they cheated. So then they separated them and tested them. They all scored in the 93rd percentile. It took 6 months before they were finally commissioned, and I met one about 6 years ago who was a rear admiral. And so that's the kind of courage and fortitude that our forefathers exhibited, that the best defense against genocide is to be necessary.
Well, let me ask the question about the two of you, what you just were talking about, Bob Whitson. And once again, Bob, what was the name of the Navy group?
The Magnificent 13.
I'll have to look that one up. I did not know about that one.
Yeah.
But I will
the
now.
The Magnificent 13. Look that up.
I will look that up. But I and listen to what you were just saying, Bob, and I want to ask how we take again from the life of a man like Martin Luther King on this day. And think about the situation we're in now. I mean, you know, I was reading a book the other night over the weekend, of a new book that just came out with all of these quotes and speeches by Frederick Douglass. And in one of them, he admonished slaves who didn't stand up and in some way resist. At the same time, he was also fighting to abolish the system of slavery and enslaving African people in America. And I thought about that in terms of where we are today, and that if we take what King was saying and we think about the ideas of personal responsibility and pushing a moral and ethical way to live, but he at the same time would be pushing for a massive social change that allowed people to live a certain way. Do you know what I'm saying?
So I mean, yeah, and there's no inconsistency there.
So right. So you know, it was like it. So is there, how do start with Chuck and then go to Bob? Chuck, how do we balance that in the world today? The fight for social justice on the one hand, mm-hmm. that King represented, and the saying, look, we are a strong people and you have to stand up.
Well, I think Mr. Woodson put it quite right. There is no inconsistency. We have to work towards personal excellence in everything that we do. And at the same time, we have an obligation to address those matters in the social world that lead to racism and sexism and other forms of discrimination against others. I think this is a constant battle. You know, in her book, My Life with Martin Luther King Jr., Coretta Scott King makes the point that, you know, she says, we taught young people how to live with dignity, but we did not tell them that they would have to fight the same fight all over again, that one doing it one time is not enough. It isn't final. Every generation has to revisit those forms of oppression and discrimination. For example, slavery is not gone. Slavery exists in the world right now in terms of child labor and women who are sex slaves in the Far East and in this country, too. Slavery hasn't gone away, but legal chattel slavery was outlawed. Again, this is a perennial question. One of the things King said in the last speech that he gave before he died is he said, one of the difficulties is trying to finish that which is unfinishable. So it is a perennial work that has to be done, and it's a torch that has to be passed from one generation to the next.
But, you know, and you talked about slavery. I fought with a Donzella James, who was a state senator in Georgia, because in the city of Atlanta, in the state of Georgia, for many years, 13- and 12-year-old black girls were mm-hmm. impressed into prostitution by these pimps. Mm-hmm. And when they got, and they were dancing in strip clubs and pimped on the streets. And when they, and the laws were very lenient on them. And I worked with Donzella to make it a felony to pimp. And these men have, they pimps ball every year where they drive fancy cars. Now, why aren't the NAACP and the civil rights people, why aren't we marching on them? How can a group of black men who pimp young girls be permitted in this day and age to celebrate their sinfulness, and yet nobody challenges it?
Amen. I agree. Why are we not addressing that? Mr. Woodson, could you say something about, if you feel that it should be said, about the importance of the family?
The family is central. You know, I grew up in a blue-collar, low-income a neighborhood in South Philadelphia. This myth that somehow integration separated out middle and upper income blacks, I mean, that's a myth. We were bifurcated and separated by class most of our lives, and there were no professional blacks where I grew up. But 98% of all households had a man and a woman raising children. And so my father died when I was 9, leaving my mother to raise 5 children on her own. But there were other men that we cleaved to, the fathers of other friends of mine. And at that time, elderly people were not afraid of their grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, because, and remember, up in 1962, 85% of all black families had a man and a woman raising children. That has now declined to about 30%, just in a matter of a few decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it is the disintegration of the family and the controls that I think men exert on young men, in particular, is the reason that we have the kind of chaos that we have today, the decline in the family.
I couldn't agree more. I think if you destabilize the black family, you destabilize the black community.
Yes.
And those women raising those young men on their own are heroic, but they can't be there all the time. And those young men will go out in the street, and they will find a male role model who's a little bit older than them and might be in the gang. And this is something we need intervention with, because if we don't reach those young boys by the age of 8, it's too late. That's what I've read.
I want to also direct you to something that I use as part of my training, and that is 60 Minutes some years ago did a piece on Kruger National Park in South Africa, where 20 years ago they took these baby elephants and put them way back in the park, and then after 20 years these bull elephants became teenagers, and they began to attack villagers, killing white rhinos. They couldn't figure out what happened, and they didn't. And they went in and they found that these elephants had formed a gang, and they were testosterone levels went up, and they were mating before they would normally do, and so they had to kill 2 or 3 rogue elephants. But the way they stopped that problem was to import into the park 2 or 3 bull elephants, and within 1 week, all of the killing stopped.
Let me ask both of you this question, and to posit this is in terms of reflecting on this day, this Martin Luther King Day, 2012, and what you both have been saying. And I know it's true, too. I mean, growing up in Baltimore, almost all the people I knew in the black world had a father and a mother in the home. And as astonished as most people are here to hear this fact, is that the African-American community had the lowest out-of-wedlock birth rate of any community in America in the 1940s and 1950s. But one of the things that changed, the family did fall apart, but there are personal and social parts. This is what I was trying to get to earlier with my question about what we glean from Martin Luther King today, in that some of what we're seeing, though, is a result of the deindustrialization of America, the lack of jobs. Because one of the things that many people had, even if it was just working in a broom factory or a box factory or cleaning somebody's floors, people had jobs. Jobs kept families together because incomes were coming in the home.
Yeah.
But that had been torn asunder, not just for black America, for America in general, but especially in black America. And so, it seems to me it's double-edged. It's not just kind of taking this kind of personal responsibility and grabbing people by the collar, saying, pulling them back together, which is important, but it's also the demand for kind of social and economic justice that gives people the work they need to create the families we have to have if we're going to survive.
I think that's a huge issue, Mark. My dad in the 60s sometimes worked 3 jobs. He would work construction in the daytime. He would be a night watchman at night. And on the weekend, he would help a white family, elderly white family, with repairs. I remember his doing that and my seeing how he worked for us. But the issue was work has changed. The factories, many factories have closed. We've gone to a service economy. We've gone through to IT and information technology, where a certain level of education is specialized education is required. This is a big issue. The jobs have to be there. I'd like to hear what Mr. Woodson would say.
Well, first of all, you know, S.B. Fuller, Fuller Bush, people don't know, 6th-rate education, a multimillionaire businessman. Fuller, in 1963, warned about this at a speech before the National Chamber of Commerce, when he said what black America needs to do is really start take over these small stores in our retail stores in our communities that can generate millions of jobs. He was castigated by Jesse Jackson, and Jesse Jackson organized a boycott against Fuller, called him an Uncle Tom for advocating taking over small businesses. It almost finished Fuller, and Fuller had to then set up the first franchise and franchise Fuller Brush Company. But the message that any group's participation in the American economy is not determined by what government does. It is their small business formation rate. A healthy community generates 3 businesses per 1,000 people per year. In the black community, we now generate 3 businesses per 100,000 per year. A lot of these inmates coming out of jail, they have marketable skills. They're not afraid of the streets. We're trying to set up a taxi service. Why can't we start taxi service in our high crime areas and also food service deliveries? So there are a lot of market opportunities, but because of violence, we can't take advantage of them. So we really got to spend some time talking about how do we create businesses in our own community by those who we don't think of as being critical to that enterprise. It just takes, there's a crisis in imagination. George Bernard Shaw said, "Must a Christ die in torment in every age to save those that lack imagination?" What we lack today in the black community is imagination.
Absolutely, yes.
So, Chuck, we're about to close out, and I'd like to just, if you would, just for us, just for a second, just reflect on what Bob just said and where this hour you think has taken us.
Well, I think everything that Mr. Woodson has said is spot on. It is absolutely crucial for our survival as a competitive people in the 21st century. We're not just competing against white people in America anymore. We're competing with people all over the world. I think we understand that. One of the things we really have to do in terms of the black community is we have to tap into all of those individuals who have been written off, who have been neutralized because of the victimization theory that they can't do anything, tap into them as resources so that they create wealth in the form of businesses, in innovations, as Mr. Woodson is pointing out. And this is crucial for our survival, I believe, in a new millennium, in a new century.
Well, it's just been, to me, a very fascinating hour with the two of you, and there's so many parts of this I didn't get to. From Martin Luther King and Christian socialism and how that fits in today's world and all the other things that he talked about. But it has been a real pleasure to have the two of you with us for this whole hour. I want to thank Robert L. Woodson, founder and president of the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, author and philosopher Charles Johnson. You can also check out the work that he's doing in these year-long interviews with Ethelbert Miller on the E! Channel. All this will be tagged on our website, steinershow.org. Both these men, of course, are MacArthur Fellows, and Robert Woodson and Charles Johnson, thank you both so much for taking
this time. Thank you, and I really enjoyed it, and I'll be in touch with you, Chuck.
Hey, listen, I look forward to it. This has been an honor to appear with you on Mark's show.
All right, yeah, same here. I feel the same, Mark.
Thank you all both. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.